podcasting almost live from Northern Voice on blogosphereradio.com. You couldn't make it to Canada's first blogging conference, so we're bringing it to you. The conversation continues now.
Well, thank you. My name is Stephen Downs. I come from the other coast of Canada, Moncton, New Brunswick. I work for the National Research Council, which means that I'm a government employee, which means I don't own any of my own words. And I'm here to talk about community blogging. Now, I'm not going to talk about a bunch of people all getting together and blogging on the same website, as some people represent community blogging, because I don't really find that too interesting. What I'm going to look at is the relation between community and blogging, how blogging becomes a community, how a community becomes a group of bloggers. Basically, I have four sections. Talk a wee bit about what constitutes a community. I'm going to rant and rave against the concept of the long tail. I'm going to explore Wittgensteinian theories of meaning. I'm going to talk about distributed network semantics. Now, this may sound like it has nothing to do with community, but my intent here is to try to reframe your thoughts on what community is, what community on the web is, and what a community of bloggers is. So we ask what constitutes a community, and we look around in the real world, and we can find communities pretty easily. We just look for a city, a town, a village, a neighborhood. And what creates a community, typically, in the real world, is proximity. We are part of a community because we live in pretty much the same place that other people live. So even though you may have nothing whatsoever to do with your neighbors, you are still part of their community. And for a long time, the concept of community online was based on the same concept. And we heard about it from people like Hegel and Armstrong, and even Cliff Fagello a bit, Harold Rangold a little bit. But the idea was that a community was a place, just like a town or a village, but online we would call it a website, a portal, or these days, because we're so much more advanced, a social networking site. And the model, as defined by Hegel and Armstrong, is you set up the site, you give it a topic, you bring in some people, you give them a way to communicate, you retire to the Cayman Islands. Didn't work out that way. Now, my field of study is online learning. That's where my expertise lies. And I actually don't really know very much about social networks or blogs or things like that. In online learning, and learning schools, universities, they're almost the prototypical communities, aren't they? Where you gather all of these people into one place, you organize them into classes, you get a bunch of subjects together, you slice and dice the range of knowledge that people are supposed to have in order to become productive and obedient members of society. And online, we see the same sort of thing. In online learning, we have this thing called the learning management system, or the new 2000 version, the learning content management system. And again, it's a site, it's a place, you log on, you get your class, and your class has a bunch of lessons, and you go to the special room where you're allowed to talk to other people, and they call that the chat area or the discussion area. And in social networking, it's much the same thing, right? If you belong to Orkut, you log on to Orkut.com or Orkut.org or whatever it is. I never remember, I just type Orkut. Or you log on to Friendster or LinkedIn or even Flickr. And being a community means going to that place and being part of that community is to a large degree a matter of proximity. and in some cases persistence. I got an email the other day, this is your fourth reminder that you have not responded to this LinkedIn invitation. I'm sort of sitting there thinking, don't they have a clue yet? But I challenge the perception that these are communities, despite what it says on their homepage. All they are is proximity. They're places where there are people in the same place. But I don't think that that's what defines a community. A lot of people have written about community online, and I'm not going to rehash what they've said, except on this slide. When we look at it, Cliff Figello talks about the web of relationships and exchange of commonly valued things, among other things. Bach talks about common interests, frequent interaction, identification, and Pekin, I can't pronounce that. Pete talks about articulated patterns of relationships, roles, norms. And these accounts of community are pretty typical. They're pretty widespread, and you'll find them in most of the work that you read about online community. But I want to draw out from these descriptions two major elements that I think are probably definitive of community. First of all, the idea that there's a network. Now, a lot of people capture that by saying people can interact, people communicate, there's a place for discussion. But the essential thing here is that there is, in some sense, a relation among the people. It's not mere proximity, but they are connected in some way. And the second thing, and the important thing in my mind, is semantics. The idea that these relations are about something. That the people in a community share a common interest, common values, a set of beliefs. An affinity for cats or beekeeping. Now, we have a pretty good understanding of networks. There's been a lot of work in the theories of networks. We have a much less refined sense of meaning. Fortunately, one of my other jobs is as a philosopher, so I spent many years studying meaning. I never thought that that would be useful. In fact, there was a little sign on the wall where I took philosophy. It said, "You are not going to get a job. Give up now." I made a sign, a little piece of paper. I recognize that this will not prepare me for any future employment. So let's think about this a little bit. I'm going to come back to meaning, but I want to rant and rave a little bit. Because the long tail, as we are told repeatedly, is a property of networks, and in particular scale-free networks. And the idea here is you get a bunch of people and you start them linking to each other. And you can set this up randomly, as people start linking to whatever's handy, right? And if you do that, you're going to create a set of links. One of the neat things about this is you get the phenomenon of 6 degrees, right? If you go from one person to another person to another person, you can get anywhere in the network in just a few hops. In a group this size, probably 2 or 3 hops. And I'm just looking at the word memers. Now, what happens in a network of this type is that some people get lots of links, and other people get just a few links. If you look in the world of blogging, for example, I'm sure you've seen this written about elsewhere, a site like Boing Boing or Instapundit or Scripting News, they'll get like thousands and thousands of links. And a site like News Trolls, which is a site that I run, gets, well, one. And so you get this curve called a power law. And there's what it looks like. And on the one end, you have Instapundit with all of those links, and then you get the long tail of thousands and thousands of sites with one or two or fewer links each. Technorati, 0 links from 0 sources. Now, what creates the power law phenomenon? Well, there are two major things that have been identified. One thing is growth. The network grows over time. And the other thing is preferential attachment. Now, what that means is you're out there, you're looking for something to link to. because you're a blogger and you've just listened to Tim Bray and others, and they said link often. You think, okay, that's a good idea. I need something to link to now. You go out and you look on the blogosphere, and what are you going to link to? Well, if you just go out looking on the blogosphere, you're probably going to find Instapundit, or you're going to find Scripting News, or you'll find Scoble Site or whatever. And okay, it's better than the newspaper, so you link to them. And so two things are happening here, right? These people are getting linked to mostly because they were first. And because they were first, there was a time when they were the only things to link to, so people linked to them. And then as time went by, they were the ones who had the most links, and so consequently, they were most likely to be found by new people. So it's like, you know, the way a tree grows, right? You have a trunk of a tree, and that's where all the action is. It's not because the trunk is better than any other part of the tree. It's just the trunk was the part that was first. And all the rest of the tree has to attach itself to the trunk, because where else is it going to attach itself to? Some people have talked a lot about the long tail. And they've said, worship the long tail, mine the long tail. The long tail is where the action is. All of these people who are talking about the value and the virtue of the long tail have the unique quality of not being part of it. I live in the long tail. And I can say from my own personal perspective that people who are in the long tail would probably rather not be part of it, because we want to be read. You know, it's that old thing. It's a little off topic, but in Canada we have socialists. And socialists always say, we represent the working class. And that's kind of like the socio-economic way of saying we represent the long tail. And they come out with these platforms and these policies that identify with the working people. You ask any of the working people, they don't want to be working people. And so they're more likely to choose policies that support the rich people, because they all want to be rich, and when they're rich, they don't want to be pushed back into that long tail again. So I don't see a virtue in the long tail. Now, when you have a long tail kind of network, this is what it looks like. And there's different ways of representing this picture. I like this picture because it kind of gives you the sense. And right in the center, that's the Instapundits and the Scripting Newses, and that's where everything started, and everything's going to grow out from there. And then you get this clustering and branching phenomenon. But what you should notice about a network that looks like this is not simply that it's root and branches, it's hierarchical, isn't it? And the really important things are at the center, and then you go way out, you see that little one sticking way out there, oh, that's me.
And further on.
Now, thinking about how this comes to be, if everyone linked to everyone, there would, of course, be no long tail. We'd all be Instapundits, for good or bad. Preferential attachment occurs only because there is a shortage. And that's why we see the power laws existing in so many places. Why is there a power law in economic distribution in society? Well, generally because there's a shortage of money. And if you want to make money, you're attracted to the people who have money, because that's the only place where you can get money. Online, it's a shortage of attention, of time. You do not have time to look at the links in 4 million or 6 million blogs. It's just not going to happen. Even Scoble can only handle 1,000 blogs. He's got to be sitting there at night thinking, God, I missed most of it. So you reach out to the closest thing you can find, but the other thing that creates a scale-free network is that these attachments are, for all practical purposes, random. You reach out for what's available rather than what's good. And let me let my political stripes show a little bit. That's how Instapundit becomes Instapundit. He's available. He's easy to find. Now, my approach to this, and the reason why I rant and rave against the long tail, is that networks on my picture are defined not as a set of random connections, which when you think about it is a pretty stupid way to do it, but as a set of semantically organized connections, because community is based on meaning, not randomness. Community as proximity, you're part of the community, the same community that your neighbor is part of, that's random connections. And so that's how you find yourself in a meeting with some person who has a completely different political point of view, and you're sitting there arguing with them about how the street ought to be run because you've been put together randomly. But community as networks of semantic relations, that's where the connections between members of the community are based on the meaning of those members or of the entities in the network. In other words, in order to create community rather than a power law, we don't simply pick the most popular or the most available, we pick the most salient connection. Well, what does that mean? How does something become the most salient connection? Well, we need to analyze or look at least for a moment, what a post means, or what anything means, what a resource means. Now, when I say that, I'm saying, what does this post or this person or this resource say about the world? And one way, a very popular way of trying to fix meaning to a blog post, say, is through tagging. Tagging has been the rage. I'm also anti-tagging. Why am I anti-tagging? Well, take a post, any post, and ask yourself, what would a graph of all the possible tags for this post look like? You are going to get a power law. So you have a post, somebody's written something about the prime minister, and so, you know, you have Martin, very popular, that'd be a very commonly used tag, a tax break, that might be a commonly used tag, my goldfish, maybe once, by somebody who didn't get the concept of prime minister. You're going to get a power law curve of tags. But the thing is, if you do it that way, then the meaning of the post becomes whatever tags are sitting there in the big spike, right? So the post becomes, it means that tag, but that tag contains only a part of the meaning of the post. It's a very narrow, one-dimensional look at something that might be a lot more complex. Because the meaning of a post is not simply contained in the post. And this is where we have lots of trouble with meaning, because we all speak a language and we all understand words and sentences and paragraphs, and we think we've got a pretty good handle on how to say something about something else. And we have a pretty good handle on how we determine the meaning of, say, a word. What does the word Paris mean? Oh, no problem, right? Capital of France, right? But you know, it might also be where I went last summer, or it might also be where they speak French. When we push what we think of as the meaning of a word, the concepts, the understanding that we have falls apart pretty quickly. And the meaning of the word or the meaning of a post is not inherent in the word or in the post, but it's distributed. It consists not just of what the word or the post talks about, but in the set of relations and connections that this post has in its actual use. Or as Ludwig Wittgenstein said, meaning is use. How do you know the meaning of a word? You look at how people use it. You look at the context. You look at who uses it, where they use it, what the environment is in which it has been used, what other words are around it. And if you define meaning in that way, then the meaning of a word can't be stated as a set of necessary and sufficient conditions. It becomes something very different, something that Wittgenstein called family resemblances. When I was looking at the word community and looking for definitions of community, one of the posts or one of the definitions that I read was, well, community is like pornography. I don't know what it is, but I recognize it when I see it. And it's that sort of sense of meaning inherent in a word, in a post, and indeed in a person. Because there's two ways of looking at the world. One way is to look at the world from the point of view of words, and you try to describe things. Another way of looking at the world is to look at the patterns and try to see what emerges out of them. Now, if you look at the diagram there, that little messy bit of lines and dots is a concept. Could be any concept. Could be your blog post. Could be the word Paris. Could be your self-identity. Now, if you use words, you cut through that cluster like a knife, and you get a one-dimensional partial representation. You get an abstraction. But if you look at it from the point of view of patterns, then the meaning of that concept emerges from that cluster of entities and relations. Now, emergence is a hard concept, and I'm not going to be able to deal with it properly here. So I'll just give you the quick example and admit that I'm fudging it. Emergence is like when you recognize Richard Nixon on your television set. Now, Richard Nixon is not really on your television set, obviously. In fact, what's on your television set is a whole bunch of little dots. But the thing is, those dots are organized in such a way that when you look at the television set, you recognize that organization of dots as being similar in form to Richard Nixon. And indeed, for people like me, because I never met Richard Nixon, that's the only understanding of Richard Nixon that I have, is through this repeated pattern or organization of discrete entities. And what's important here is that the particular dots don't matter, the particular color, the particular properties of the dots don't matter. Richard Nixon is not in the pixels. Richard Nixon is in the organization of the pixels. And so we say the image of Richard Nixon is emergent from the pixels. Now, what's important here in my mind, although it's a little bit peripheral, is this doesn't happen without a perceiver, without the capacity to recognize this pattern as being Richard Nixon. Take somebody who was just born recently, wasn't around during the 70s, doesn't know why scandals always have the word gate attached to them. Show them a picture of Richard Nixon and go, oh, some guy. Got a bit of a sweaty upper brow. Otherwise, I don't know who it is. You have to have a context in which to recognize a pattern in a network. When we use words, that warps it because we're going after the big spike. And words actually distort because they pull the pattern into themselves. And people start thinking, well, the word is the concept. The concept is the word. Of course, it isn't. But because we're focused on this big spike and because the meaning of the concept is being derived from the word, the meaning becomes the word. If we think of meaning as use, then what is the meaning of a blog post? What does a blog post talk about? It's not contained in the post. Rather, it's contained in the network of relations in which the post finds itself. In the referrers, in the use, in the connections with other things, in evaluations of the post. A whole variety of different connections, different relations are possible, which could, and in my opinion, will be used to characterize an individual post. So, if we look at the two pictures of meaning of posts, On one picture, if we think of meaning as inherent in the post and maybe describable in words, we get an organization of meanings that looks very much like the network that's formed through random connections. Because the word, when attached to a concept, a post, is more or less random. I was looking on the Northern Voice website, and they said, when you're tagging this, please use, and then they gave me a string. They could have used any string. They used, I forget what they used, Northern Voice or whatever. But they could have used QXPYTZ. That would have worked just as well. It's random. And you end up with a clustering that looks just like one of these scale-free networks. But if meaning is thought of as distributed, as being derived from the relations and not just the content of the word, then you get a very different looking network, a very different pattern. Now, why does this matter? It matters this way. If we're deriving meaning and connections and communities in a random fashion, everything flows from the big spike. Scoble was up here saying, my friend was saying, I want you to link to me. And he said, that's not how it works. Create something of value, he said, right? And I will decide whether it's worth linking to. That's the big spike telling the long tail what to do, isn't it? That's what happens when meaning derives from the center. And if you push it, that sort of organization and arrangement requires control. Look at technoratty tags. Now, we've already gotten some tag spam, and we've already gotten some structured vocabulary in technoratty tags, and eventually somebody will come out and propose an ontology of technoratty tags or a taxonomy, and they will say, everyone should do it this way. And anyone who doesn't, well, they're being chaotic, they're being disruptive. But if the idea emerges from the pattern of connections between individuals, there's no one in control. Scoble can't tell me what to write in my blog, and it doesn't matter whether or not he links to me or I link to him. And the dynamics in such a network are completely different. This works if you have freedom. This works if nobody tells you how to tag. This creates order and relevance and meaning through diversity, not conformity. Two very different pictures of community. So how do we pull this off? How do we kill the big spike? How do we transform tagging from something that people can use to spam to something that can actually get us to the point where we have meaningful communities? Well, you come back to online learning, because again, that's what I know about. And in online learning, what's happening is, and it's very slow, and there's a lot of resistance because people who are part of the big spike don't want to let go, right? And the people in the online learning world who are part of the big spike, they're university presidents, they're publishers and authors, they're the top researchers in the field, whatever. And they don't want to let go. In a classroom, you have the teacher, that's the big spike, and you have all the little students there, the long tail. But what's happening in online learning very slowly, very reluctantly, is a shift from centralized, place-based networks into something more distributed. We're getting to the point where learning resources are available not from a given place, not from a given authority, but from out there on the network. And what we're after, at least some of us, those of us who are in the long tail, what we're after is a way of being able to recognize in something that doesn't require tagging 6 million items, the posts, the resources that are salient to us as individuals. Now, people don't get that in the online world, and I don't think they get that in social networking. And so there's always this talk about, look, we got to standardize. It's the only way the system will work is standardize. And I go to online learning conferences, and I tell them, well, the most popular form of XML in the world today is RSS. There is no standard. In fact, there are 9 or so different varieties, according to Mark Pilgrim, and who knows what there will be tomorrow, but that's the thing that's working. Educational communities, the old way, nice, neat topics, classes, and so on. But this kind of structure, both in schools and in the blogosphere, where you have the flow coming from the top, is ripe for abuse. And then there's another one from J.D. Lassica, just came out today, about influence peddling in the blogosphere. And of course, we heard mentioned earlier the Raging Cow and the Lincoln Fries. Eventually, these companies are going to get good at this. Like right now, they're screamingly bad. But they are eventually going to become good. 43 things had the entire blogosphere fooled for a couple of weeks. And it sort of fell apart. Eventually, there will be things that don't fall apart. I look at the Wall Street Journal opinion columns, and they are defining from the top down. There's a whole bunch of people out there who echo the words that they see in these opinion columns. They don't know what they mean because there is no context. They're just echoing the words, and it just becomes a way for the Wall Street Journal to broadcast. Future learning environments place the individual at the center. That's where it says future VLE. And a range of resources that they bring in or that they aggregate from a wide variety of different sources. Notice it's, he has 43 things on there. That actually places at that diagram at a precise moment in history. And if you look at community in this picture, then you're able to draw out a theory of community, where a community is defined by 3 major components. First, as a means of organizing input and experience. Second, as a means of putting that experience into context. What does it mean to you here now? And then third, and very importantly, as a means of taking what you've done, what you've remixed, what you've repurposed, and putting it out there so it can become part of someone else's meaning. Can you just imagine how the copyright barons look at this kind of model of organization, right? Community is antithetical to copyright, and conversely. The idea here is that the community is defined as the relations between the members, where the relations have semantical value, where that semantical value is defined by the relations. And I know it sounds like bootstrapping, but we've been doing that throughout history. People exist in relations to other people, to things, to resources, even to spaces. So how do we pull this off? We can't just blast 4 million blogs, 8 quadrillion blog posts out there and hope Technorati will do the job, because Technorati won't do the job, because Technorati represents the whole 4 million things, and I'm not interested in 3,999,000 of those. What has to happen is this mass of posts has to self-organize in some way, which means there has to be a process of filtering, but filtering that is not just random, and filtering that isn't like spam blocking. Filtering has to be a mechanism of determining what it is we want, because it's a lot easier to determine what we want than what we don't want. So how do we do this? We create a representation of the connections between people and the connections between resources. The first pass at this I described in a paper a couple of years ago called the Semantic Social Network. And the idea, very simply, is we actually attach author information to RSS about blog posts. It kills me that this hasn't happened, because this is a huge source of information. And all you need to do is in the item, in say the DC creator tag, put a link to a FOF file. And all of a sudden we've connected people with resources, people with each other, and therefore resources with each other. And that gives me a mechanism for finding resources that is not based on taxonomies, is not based on existing knowledge and existing patterns, but is based on my placement within a community of like-minded individuals. Now, InstaPundit stuff probably isn't going to filter through to that, but really cool stuff like Dave Pollard's stuff will. Now, that semantic social network is just a first pass at this. We want to create these connections on many levels. And so what we want is metadata, not simply created by the author of a post, but created by readers of posts. This is why I call third-party metadata. Third-party metadata, we're beginning to see some of this out there in the blogosphere in a small, limited, and usually site-based way, right? Links, references, ratings, annotations, classifications, contexts of use. But it can't be site-based, because that doesn't create a network. It might as well be random. Now, we've talked about this in the field of learning resources, because professors love ratings. But we could also do this in the blog world with RSS. It's very simple to do. You just create a tag that looks just like any other item tag, except you're not the author of that item. And you identify it in some way, usually through a link. And then you add your third-party metadata. This is the SSN, stands for Semantic Social Networks. I made it up. Commentary is the type of third-party metadata. I made it up. And then who wrote it and what they had to say. And that becomes third-party metadata. It becomes information about the resource. Now, the way this should work and the way I've proposed for this to work in the educational community is that as much of this third-party metadata as possible is created through automatic means. Now, annotations aren't going to be created automatically, but a context of use will, right? If I look at a resource while I'm taking a physics class, then the context of use of that resource is in physics. And so I know, even if the resource is like a picture of a rabbit, I know that that picture is related to that subject because I looked at that picture in that class. And the system that I'm using to look at that picture should note that and log it. And what's relevant? I looked at that picture. Now, that attaches everything that anyone knows about me to that picture. And so we get enormously rich descriptions through very simple mechanisms of automatic classification. My contention is that instead of the spike-based, power law-based, InstaPundit-based network, that when we get something like the semantic social network, and we will get something like the semantic social network because it's very simple to do, patterns of organization will be created. In the field of neural networks and connectionism, they call them clusters. You get a cluster phenomenon where we're not creating communities around a specific word or a specific concept, but the community itself emerges as being created by and defined as that particularly dense set of connections. I've set up a system called EduRSS, which is a very primitive first pass at this. And the idea here, EduRSS is an aggregator. There should be many instances of EduRSS. In the ideal world, everyone would have something like this on their desktop. And it pulls in the link metadata, but it also pulls in rating metadata. And it doesn't pull it in from the entire world the way Technorati does or the way Blogdex does. It pulls it in from my community, my network of friends. And if you set up the network in this way, you can actually stop worrying about searching because the network itself becomes the search, where you go through layers of linking, and so what comes out the other end is stuff that will be of interest to you. And if you're finely grained enough at the output end, then you can get a very precise set of inputs. But the thing is, the set of inputs come from the entire blogosphere of 4 million people rather than the randomly chosen top 100. The community is the network. There is no centralized place that constitutes the community. There are only people and resources that are distributed, that are acting on their own behalf and then in their own interests. If you ever read Marvin Minsky's The Society of Mind, it's like that. Where the network consists of a set of self-selected relations using a variety of contextual information that I've defined as third-party metadata to establish meaning. And where this meaning not only defines the community, but emerges from the community. And that's probably all of my time, and I thank you very much for your patience.
So we do have how would something like Wikipedia fit into this theory?
Oh, I have a slide I didn't use. And the slide that I didn't use was something along the lines of, wouldn't it be neat if we had an engine that looked at every one of Wikipedia's pages and looked at the connections we could begin by, the connections between words, and then eventually the connections between instances of regular expressions in each of these million articles. Now, I guarantee you clusters would form. And I guarantee you that these clusters would not be organized in the way that we would find subject material organized today, that it would be a new form of organization. Now, I could be wrong, it's an empirical thing. And then we use that as a classification method so that for any given post, you take the post, you run it through the same algorithm that you ran through Wikipedia, and that places your post in context with one or more Wikipedia posts, and that defines the subject. I think that would be very neat. I'll bet you that's what Google's up to.
Thank you, Nick.
I got lost somewhere along the way there.
Sorry.
I think it was relevant. I'm interested in physics. You're teaching a physics class. I search on physics, I think
Well, yeah, but this is what I mean. Like, you use words, you're slicing through. The meaning that you got out of that by taking one little piece of what I said is something absurd. Physics equals rabbit. Well, of course physics doesn't equal rabbit. And if you got a rabbit when you were looking for something about physics, you would be quite rightly annoyed. But if your search was creating something that only looked at that one dimension of the many layers of connections and relations having to do with that image, then you should expect to get rabbits for physics. The picture of the rabbit does not exist only with the tag was once looked at in a physics class. The picture of the rabbit has a history, just like I have a history, just like you have a history, right? There's the origin of the rabbit, where the rabbit was born, who created the rabbit. And then as the picture of the rabbit grows up, it acquires more and more properties through different types of use. The picture of the rabbit was used here. The picture of the rabbit was used there. The picture of the rabbit was criticized by somebody who was talking about geophysics, whatever. So my use of the picture of the rabbit in a physics class is only one small part of the meaning of that rabbit. But you know, here's the flip side. If you are in almost exactly the same situation that I am, or that I was, and you're working on physics, and you need the one image that's going to do the trick for you, there's no taxonomy-based system would ever give you the picture of the rabbit. But if you're in the same position that I was, the rabbit might be exactly what you need. So the idea here is we don't just compare word to picture. We compare entire contexts to entire contexts. And that allows us not simply to describe, but it allows us to project, to be able to predict what the meaning of something will be, predict the unpredictable.
Someone else? Yeah.
Thank you. Just an observation, I think I've been telling my students for a while, the reason the top-down knowledge management systems, the reason the top-down ontology systems, the reason the top-down taxonomies don't tend to work for actually finding information is because the whole goal of those systems is to decontextualize the information. And for individual users, there's no interest in decontextualizing.
Right.
So the bottom-up stuff has a much better chance of working for you. And if it works for you, then it might work for somebody else who has a similar content.
That's a really nice summarization of the point. I wish it picked up on my microphone. But the point was that the reason why these top-down systems don't work is that they decontextualize the description of the resource. But if the description is decontextualized, then it's not useful for me because I live in a context-laden environment. Well,
voting for the use of the word in a sense.
Yeah.
Well, there's things with tagging, right? People lie.
Call me a liar.
What tagging is an explicit attempt to attach words to posts or to concepts, right? And inherently, there's nothing particularly wrong with that, except that, first, the word always under-describes the resource. But second, the word often mis-describes the resource. And as soon as the spammers and the pornographers and the Viagra dealers get into the tagging system, all these, you know, sites that are selling Viagra or whatever, they're going to be about communities because they were tagged community. Or they're going to be about blogs because they were tagged about blogs. But there's another thing, too. There's the big spike aspect to tagging. Because I went to the Technorati tagging site, and it's, you know, the most popular 100 tags, you know, the real popular ones in big bold, right? The very top of the big spike, and I looked at them, right? You know, those ones tagging, right? Another one's community. Another one was general. I'm looking at these popular tags, and they're useless to me. If I don't know what I'm looking for, I'll never find it. If I don't know what the tag is that captures that collection of resources, I'm not going to get it in the top big spike, top 100 list in Technorati, but there's no place where I can find it in the bottom. I have to start searching randomly. And just to take it one step further, if I want to find a resource, I have to conform to the tagging regimen that has been previously established. It's like searching for resources on the old Yahoo, right? You wanted to find anything on Yahoo which had these categories or that long, you had to think like a Yahoo person.
That's the whole Wittgensteinian idea where you buy into language.
But I don't want to buy into that one.
But that's what language is.
But with tagging, there's only one community.
Such a bad name, right? It would be a little dogmatic if I could use the dog word. And Basically, the Flickr tagging experience is an amazing experience.
Now.
And that is a folksonomy, truly spontaneously formed thing. And the moment the Viagra guys get in there, Stuart Butterfield will kick them out. I mean, really is, that's the benefit of a centralized environment. You can have control. You can have control of pure anarchy. And so...
That's the purpose of a centralized environment, so you can have control.
But if the folksonomy folks can enjoy themselves and they type blue, and they come with all these beautiful blue photos, then it's working. That's not a bad thing.
But
that's fun.
Oh, it's fun, but is it useful?
Well, it's fun to them. They're doing it. Who are you to say that it's not good?
I'm the long tail. It's not good to me because I type blue and I get all these irrelevant things.
On the pedestal, telling us what's good. That's
academic.
He asked
him
to go on the pedestal.
Yeah.
Well, that's not to be on the pedestal. Two quick things. One, I found it really ironic who you quoted in your presentation because they were all people of importance and people that everyone else was talking about and people that everyone else was already linking to, and it was like you were long-tailing us, but why the long tail with that?
Sure.
And which I just found really, really ironic.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good point.
The second thing is that it's almost like if you applied what you're asking for to language, it would be like, I could say whatever I want, and you would get whatever meaning you want, whether we spoke the same language or not, which isn't entirely practical. Even if it's something you want, it's not very practical for me to go spot in front of you guys and just say any syllable I want and hope that through some magic or software you will understand what I mean.
Well, I mean,
there are arbitrary things in communication
that happens. Well, that assertion is the equivalent of saying, oh, it'll never work.
No.
but what's the reason for that? I mean, I use the word Paris. Okay? And this is me showing it working, right? I use the word Paris. Now, how many of you know what Paris means? All of you. How many of you have the same exact same understanding of the word Paris as the person next to you? I would wager none. You all have a different meaning, a different understanding of the word Paris. And the reason why you have that understanding that you do is the word Paris has been used in different ways in your life. Like the embedding of a word in a context does not occur without a context. And you're saying, oh, well, if you ignore the context, it'll never work. No, I'm asking for a system that captures the context and recognizes the context. Another way of putting the tags thing, tagging is context free. There is no relation of a tag to...
It's the context of Flickr. It's the context of Technorati. It's those vendors and operators who put that system out there.
It's the context of this closed centralized system. Sure.
Okay, we could maybe squeeze in one more question, or I could let those people who wish to eat go to lunch, and those people who wish to discuss come down the front and go for it. Everyone else should be back at 1:30. One request, I notice a heck of a lot of coffee cups and things around here. If people could take their coffee cups and just put them on one of the tables outside so they don't get knocked over and broken and all that sort of stuff. And thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, folks.
This has been a Blogosphere Radio special presentation, almost live from Northern Voice. Be sure to check out northernvoice.ca and blogosphereradio.com for more information.